song of the militant romance. Again let me do a lot of extraordinary talking. Again let me do a lot. Let me abound in speeches. Let me abound, publicly polyglot. Better a blind word to bluster with. Better a bad word than none, lieber Gott. Watch me push into my witch's vortex all the Englishman's got to cackle and rattle with. You catch my intention to be busily balking with tongue-tied Briton. That is my outlandish plot. To put a spark in his damp peat, a squib for the Scotchman, starch for the Irish. To give a Teutonic come Scot, breadth to all that is slender in Anglo come Oxford or Saxony, over pretty in Ari, to give to this watery galaxy a Norseman's sea-salted stamina, drammed Wolfgang's salt blood. As to the trick of the prosody, the method of conveying the matter, frankly, I shall provoke the maximum saxophone clatter. I shall not take limping iambics, nor borrow from Archilochus his light horse gallop, nor drive us into a short distance that would bog us. I shall not go back to Sheltonics, nor listen to Dr. Guest. I know with my bold Fortina, I have the measure that suits us best. I shall drive the matter along as I have driven it from the first. My peristalsis is well nigh perfect, in burst upon well-timed burst. I shall drive my coach and four through the strictest of physical treatises. I do not want to know too closely the number of beats it is. So shipwreck the nerves to enable the vessel the better to float. This cockle shell's what it first was built for, and a most seaworthy boat. At roll call, Baron Dominus uttered at a fool's school, shouted by Scottish ushers, caused his lordship to sob like a fool. Yet Baron was the first to laugh at the oversensitive Keats, snuffed out by an article, those were the words. A couple of rubber teats should have been supplied beyond any question to these overtouchy pets. For me, you are free to spit your hardest and explode your bloody spleen regarding my bold, compact Fortina or my four less than 14. So set up a shouting for me. Get a Donnybrook racket on. Hound down the drowsy let in Goliaths that clutter the lexicon. Send a contingent over to intone in our battle line. Wrench the trumpet out of the center of a monkish leonine. Court-martial the stripling stackers who dance in the dull rhyme royal. Send staggering out all the stammerers who stick round as Chaucer's foil. Dig out the dogs from the doggerel of the hudibrastic couplet. Hot up the coldest mutton songbirds of the Plantagenet cabinet. Go back to the confessor's palace and disentangle some Anglo-Saxon and borrow a bellow or two from the Pictish or from the Manxman. Set all our mother tongue reeling with the eruption of obsolete vocables. Disrupt it with all the grammars that are ground down to cement it. With obstacles, strew all the cricket pitches, the sleek tennis lawns of our tongue. Install a nasty cold in our larynx, a breathlessness in our lung. But let me have silence always in the center of the shouting. That is essential. Let me have silence so that no pin may drop and not be heard, and not a whisper escape us for all our spouting, nor the needle scratching upon this gramophone of a circular cosmic spot. Hear me, mark me, learn me, throw the mind's ear open. Shut up the mind's eye, all will be music. What? Sculpture of sound cannot. What cannot? As a fluid token, words, that nothing else cannot. If so the man you are, if so the man you are to pick up sticks, then why expect to have a house of bricks? Merchant of fag ends, if that's what you are, why should they give you a full-size cigar? If so the man you are, commissionaire, stock still to stand for a pittance, why, that's fair. If so the man you are, I can't see why, whacked from your hobo holding, you need cry. Bellata or gold, if so the man you are, the optimist prospector spit on your star. Who would hand out a hoot if such a man had fits of grief? I don't see how I can. If so the man you be to set your cap at Croesus' crooked daughters, you're a low chap. For you may marry gold or ships or rubber, only if you're a proper money grubber. If so the man you be, I'm betting, boy, you're not that cold, well-turned, steel-hammered toy. If so the man you were, upon my lice, I'd not give you this spate of good advice. Since so the man you are to turn your back upon the baton, so I think in your knapsack. If so the man you are, commissionaire, if so the man, marchand de mego there, if so the man you are, omer d'alor, if so the man, to bang each taxi door, if so the man, be meddled a man's man too, if so the man you are to all men true, if so you are the servant man, why then, if so the man, a scarecrow among men, if such the man you are, these words we waste, If so, the man by nature's hand disgraced. If so, the man you be for the back seat. If so, the man out of the hand to eat. A fetch and carry fellow to salute. If so, the man that's just above the brute. If so, the man like the majority of men. If so, the man that's envious of the pen. If so, the man you are of the other cheek. If so, the man that's venomous and sleek. If so, the man that's every man. These words, if so, a man, we throw to the dicky birds. End of enemy interlude. I knew you'd like the enemy. He's the person may pen in plastic fashion a new verse on the Helden label and colossalized lot, or with his pen put pen clubs on the spot. He knows to live comes first. No bee in his bonnet outbuzzes any other that lands on it. His balance is astonishing when you consider he has never sold himself to the highest bidder, never has lived a week for 20 summers free of the drum fire of the camouflage gunners, never has eaten a meal that was undramatic without the next being highly problematic, never succumbed to panic, cultus blut his watchword, facing ahead in untroubled mood. He has been his own bagman, critic, cop, designer, publisher, agent, char man, and shoe shiner. What he has just narrated of double-dealing is nothing to what he could, of professional stealing, of the betrayal of unpublished texts to ladies, our Quoddy Day, and other crimes. His fate is, of course, to be a quarry of rich pickings. He's the bullseye of brain pickers like the Dickens, of unwelcome names blue-penciled in an article, caught in the act and minding not a particle. We suffer from a strange delusion, that is, that our age is straighter than was granddaddy's, of that discrimination against all writers suspected of having eyes in their heads. Good fighters when driven in corners are common, but here's a fellow who does not wait to be trapped, an aggressive fellow. I was sure you'd like him, and that was why I brought him. It was a piece of luck. It happened that I caught him.
Wyndham Lewis was very fond and interested in putting down his first recollections of meeting various people, you know, like Joyce and Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot and so on, and I was wondering if I could turn the tables and ask you what were the circumstances, etc., of your first meeting with Lewis.
I went round to the studios with a girlfriend who was a model. That's how I met him.
How did he kind of strike you in those
I days? Was very impressed with him, and frankly it was the first time I'd ever met an artist. It's the first time that any artist ever showed me his work, and I know he showed me an old drawing that impressed me terrifically.
How did you get to know him after that? Did you sort of return to the studio?
No, I didn't return to the studio, but he invited me out to dinner, and that's how the whole thing started. We used to go to a place called Pagani's. I don't know if it's even going now. Mm. It's a marvellous little place. And Kepner's also in Regent Street.
I suppose he was working quite consistently then as a painter.
Yes, yes, he hadn't started writing, well, he had started writing, as you know, because he did that before the war. Even when he was in Paris, he was keeping a diary. He used to go to France with his mother, and he kept a diary then about the peasants there. And that's the first time. Whether he did it when he was younger, I don't know.
I think there are some things he wrote about putting down his ideas or doing something and making up some books out of paper and stapled together or something.
Yes, I remember that. Toilet paper, wasn't it?
Ah, it didn't say in the book what sort of paper it.
He was a great conversationalist, and it didn't matter who you were. Mm. Even the charwoman he'd talked to, which is very useful for his books. In fact, in Canada, when we were in Canada, we had a Scotch maid there, and she used to come in, and they had long conversations, and the manageress. He was interested in everything, and everybody, on trains, anywhere, he'd get into conversation with people. He had a terrific amount of curiosity. Mm. Of course, as a person of that sort ought to have. But then he started writing. That was in the very early 20s. Really seriously writing. I mean, he was writing The Art of Being Ruled. Mm. In fact, the whole thing was one large book. All those books, Time and Western Man, Art of Being Ruled. There were two or three others. And then it was so large, he took it to Castles, and it was too expensive to print. It was called The Man of the World, and after that, he split them up. I mean, even part of the Childermaths was supposed to go in the middle of that.
Yes. But he had some bad sort of experiences with publishers, didn't he?
Well, at that time they were very unadvanced, let's say. And you had to get hold of a very serious firm like Jettam and Windus. I mean, who were much more serious. He got hold of Castles.
How many years did you spend in America and Canada altogether?
Five and a half, something like that. He had a lot of trouble there, but mainly in Canada. He wrote a book about Canada, which is rather stupid of him. I mean, it was against America.
Yes.
That's what's so funny.
Yes.
I mean, praising up Canada, I mean,
yes.
As regards America.
Yes.
They didn't take it that way. It's surprising how Lewis, I mean, they always talk about Lewis as if he wasn't a social character, but he was a very social character. He made friends wherever he went.
He didn't really undertake too much kind of commercial work as such, did he?
He did a few articles. He did in the 20s. Beaverbrook was rather friendly with him then.
Mm.
And did a few things for the Evening Standard. But of course you can't. You were under their almost tutelage. I mean, that time you have to write what they want. And he didn't like that. Yes, he was a very independent man. I think it's much better if you can possibly do it.
Yes.
Of course you get very hard up.
What about his poetry? One Way Song?
Well, that was just a thing, you know, it just happened.
Yes.
I remember him sitting down, I saw him scribbling away, and that evolved into a one-way song.
Seems from things he's written, he's always sort of been involved in you know, self-analysis and made every decision with a great deal of care.
Yes, well, sometimes not so much care. I mean, I think he got involved with politics too much. And that's always destroying, that's a destructive thing, I think. I think an artist should step aside myself, or a writer. I know in the 20s he had a great deal of difficulties, but he did stick to it as much as he possibly could, things that he believed in and so on. He did a certain amount of portraits, but he didn't like portraiture, not with people. I mean, without paying, they always want to look like a screen star or the other, and he didn't do that kind of work.
How did sitters react to his form of stylization in his portraits?
On the whole, very good. It was extraordinary. They knew what they were sitting with for a person who had his definite ideas of what he was going to do, and he wouldn't alter them, maybe prettify them occasionally, but he wouldn't alter them.
See, did a lot of portraits of you, didn't he? There's one.
Oh, yes, well, I mean, a model on the premises.
What sort of artist did he favour?
Well, of course, he was one of the first people, in fact, he was the first person to praise Bacon. He had a great admiration of Bacon, whether it was the content or the painting. I mean, because Bacon is a marvellous painter, and wonderful painter.
It's interesting, actually, reading his recollections of meeting Asquith, the Prime Minister, he was invited to number 10 Downing Street.
Mm. Of course, all those people were much more interested in art then. He was, of course, Asquith, he was a scholar, he knew Greek and everything like that, I mean, a classical scholar.
Yes.
And they're not like that today. I think Viola Tree was there, Margaret Asquith. One, I expect like you, I mean, we all were shy, and Lewis was very shy. I was very surprised when I went about in St. Louis with him. In some people's company, he was exceedingly shy. He didn't like politicians.
It's interesting in reading his accounts of meeting Asquith, where I think Asquith was fairly curious as to the sort of meaning of this modern movement, the voices and all
that. I know, wasn't that extraordinary? They always see things in the political terms, these people. But what they ought to have remembered, that they were the political people, not he.
Yes. Did he ever talk about his first meeting with James Joyce?
Yes, he used to. He liked Joyce very much. In fact, I think Joyce liked him too. People make a lot of out of the attack on Joyce, wasn't on Joyce on his thing that he was doing. But it wasn't so serious as all that, because Joyce came over here, had was interested in this tenor,
yeah.
And Lewis introduced him to Lady Cunard, but nothing came of that. So I don't know what happened to that tenor, do you?
No, I don't actually.
I think he was a tenor.
Yeah, Lewis was ill quite frequently, wasn't he? Particularly at one stage, he was quite seriously ill.
Oh, yes. Well, he was ill from about 1933 onwards. And he had an operation which wasn't successful. In fact, the surgeon had an accident which left him with an illness all his life. He'd wash him back up and then had a sort of collapse up and then get over it. And but the whole time, even when we went to Canada, to America, often it left him with a sort of a malaria effect. He'd have the same symptoms, which come on very quickly. Campbell apparently had malaria too. Campbell and he were great friends. He was another amusing man. He's not very popular because of his attack on Bloomsbury's. I don't know why the Bloomsbury's shouldn't be attacked. I mean, the books I'm reading, I mean, I think they ought to.
You seem to have a sort of strange relationship with the Bloomsbury's, and apparently they carved out quite a chunk of the sort of literary benefits that were going in those days. Did he?
Oh, yes.
Did he sort of resent that? Or
yes.
He did?
Yes. I mean, Fry mainly. It wouldn't have continued like that, but Fry was one of those people, a spoilt, very spoilt rich man, who, I mean, for anyone to go against him was a...
Social suicide.
Absolutely. And, I mean, he had so many things, and he monopolised the whole thing. I mean, America had the thing, I've forgotten the things they bought for, but all sorts of galleries. And this was completely barred.
Because he had a rather difficult experience in the Omega workshop,
yes.
Didn't he?
Yes.
Did Lewis ever talk about what happened, apart from
he didn't like it, obviously.
Yes.
Because you did these things, and I mean, what he said, you know, Fry would only give him curtains and things like that to decorate. And that annoyed him. That's one of the things that annoyed him.
Hmm.
And then there was a mix-up about that. You got that in his own book about the pictures and things like that. And they were two opposite characters. Fry was very conniving. And, of course, Lewis shouldn't have gone, but I don't know. There you are, I'm saying he shouldn't have gone there. Because Lewis really was a person who worked best on his own. In fact, I think it's the best way to work,
yeah. Personally.
I don't know who paid for the vortices. I suppose his mother paid a certain amount.
When you say his mother paid, how do you mean the actual magazine itself?
The actual magazine, yes. Yeah. Otherwise, at one time, I mean, he'd go, well, for the Apes of God, for instance, he'd send out a thing of a subscription list. And after he got a certain amount of subscriptions, he'd go to the printer. You could do those sort of things at that time, and they were much more lenient. I mean, today, well, that's what a pity of it. Nobody will do that. It's such big business now.
What was his kind of relationship then with Fry? I mean, did he...
Wouldn't speak to one another. So Lewis resented, I mean, he didn't go on, but he resented this boycott of him in the 20s. That's why he went to writing.
Yes.
Went on as well, you do it one way, I'll do it the other. In his book, he has a letter by Clive Bell,
yes.
Saying, well, you know what Fry is. I mean, he'll go on like this. And
yes.
Things like that, which, but of course Clive Bell again took up the same sort of attitude later on.
Did he talk much about the Sitwells?
Well, I met the Sitwells when I went to Adam and Eve, and they came in, as he said, in formation.
They must have been an incredible family. From...
Yes, they were. They were amusing family. William Wharton was alive. He's made his. Marks now, it's taken them a long time.
That's Facade. Edith Sitwell and
William
Wharton.
Yes. They tried to, they had a repeat.
Yeah.
He was really mad about art. He really thought it was something good in the world. I think that's the only thing he thought.
Yes, there's a painting in the Tate Gallery, isn't there, the famous one by him of Edith Sitwell.
Oh, yes. She was rather funny. I remember Nurse telling me how she came down. She wore a short fur coat, and she had this hat on her head, and she came down, and when she arrived in the studio, she said, "The children have been jeering at me in the street at my hat." He said, "What do you do?" She said, "I turned round and poked my tongue out at them." And that silenced them. They were an interesting family.
Yes. Yeah. Did he ever talk about Yeats?
Oh, yes. And the last time, he rather liked Yeats. I think he really liked his poetry. And wasn't the last thing he saw Yeats in Regent Street, I think it was. Came across him, and he said, "Yeats has lost him. As soon as he saw me, he pushed up that Irish accent." They were very friendly at one time. I know at Ossington Street, Yeats used to come around there quite often. Mm. And he was very interested. Lewis was painting a lot of things with towers, and this interested him. He said, "That's what interests me. It's just what I feel about. About life and what he meant by that, God knows." He was very friendly with a man called Sullivan, who was a music critic, and he was a friend of Aldous Huxley.
Oh, yes.
And Aldous Huxley was very much in love with Nancy Cunard, and he was very upset when she took up with Lewis. I don't think he admired Aldous Huxley very much. In fact, I'm sure he didn't.
From the point of view of Huxley's sort of vision of the world?
Yes, he thought it was... he took a page, he thought it was badly written. He printed that, and of course that didn't endear him to Aldous Huxley. It's funny how they took Lewis so seriously. I mean, when I look back, I mean, I should have just disregarded it. I mean, much better. But he was very hurt about it. So his brother said.
What about his sort of meeting with Marinetti, the futurists, and so on? Because there are some marvellous stories, aren't there, about sort of public lectures where...
Marinetti came over here, as you know, with his band, and, and of course it was all advertising. And so they went around, Lewis got to, the whole band together, was with Etchells, who were the other people?
Fresca.
And they went round and interrupted them and shouted at them and this, that and the other. And of course it created terrific, I mean, the Marinettes didn't mind, it created a sort of new interest in them.
Did he got to know Marinetti after that?
Yes.
Did he talk much about Ezra Pound?
Oh yes, I mean, he knew Ezra Pound extremely well. And he was very fond of him. He was another very lively man. But funnily enough, if you gave a dinner party, it would both be quiet. Because the other people made the conversation.
Really? Really?
Ezra Pound was a little bit cagey. only when they were alone, they were very busy talking upstairs when he was doing the last portrait of Pound.
Yes.
Yeah, they were jawing away and laughing, and they were having a hell of a time up there. The only time ever, of course, he must have laughed elsewhere was Eliot. He used to have a great time. Mainly Lewis's jokes or remarks amused Eliot.
He also knew Augustus John, of course.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they were great companions during France and so on.
Yes.
They were both in France at the same time. I think he first saw him at Slade when John came down from Liverpool, where he was teaching, and he came into the art class there. It was then he met him, first meeting at the Slade. Yes, he liked John, and John liked him. They used to quarrel. I mean, that's all friends do. It's a funny thing, he's never, never gone down well with the French, John. Extraordinary. Mm.
Lewis tells a very amusing story of when John first arrived one morning through the door in a large black hat and a cape and sat down on a donkey and started...
yes, started drawing.
Yeah. And then presumably Lewis got to know him after that.
No, he got to know him at that time.
Did he?
Mm, yes, so he soon went out. Lewis didn't drink at that time. And John was always rather fond of drink. And he used to go around these pubs drinking lemonade and stuff. It was not until John became very famous that he used to come around at Notting Hill Gate. I know, he was always very fond of making fools of women. I shouldn't tell this story.
Please do it.
Well, I wasn't him. I locked the door. I knew, our bedroom was just against the bathroom.
Yes.
And I knew he'd come down from the studio, so I locked and took that, and we had a little dog then. I took the dog in with me and locked the door. I thought, no nonsense here, a nice little story to tell. And so I locked the door, and sure enough, he tried that handle. No stories. Bar the locked door.
Yes. You, Brother Lewis had a sort of a studio in Notting Hill Gate.
Yes, the studio had a place underneath, a two-room flat,
yes.
Underneath, and the studio was upstairs. It's a very shabby place.
Lewis insisted on absolute quiet when he worked.
Mm. Yeah. Otherwise he'd... well, it does interrupt your thoughts.
Mm. How generally did Lewis's painter friends relate to him, in as much as, you know, Lewis was obviously a highly intelligent man who wrote a great deal, which a lot of...
Well, you know what he said about the majority of painters? They were all dumb. Various people he liked. A person he liked very much was Sickert. He was very fond of Sickert, who was another lively character. Wadsworth, he knew.
Mm.
And of course they became, they inherited money and became instantly a rich man.
Mm.
And Dick Windham, they knew. He liked Dick Windham.
Mm.
And Dick Windham came around to the studio, and the last studio that we had, not long before his death.
Mm.
At the last, he did a lot of reviewing of the art shows and things like that.
What are your recollections of the exhibition at the Tate Gallery?
First day's show, that he was going to turn back because he felt ill, and I had to say, no, you must come. Even then we had to go in the back way. He could hardly manage the stairs, and he sat silently in the gallery the whole time. He didn't say anything to anybody.
Yes. Had he lost his sight at that stage?
Oh, yes, he was blind.
He was. I mean, that must have been an incredible sort of problem.
It was, because it's very difficult to, for a person like Lewis, very difficult to adapt. I mean, he was all right with it when he was with people he knew very well. I mean, friends of his. Then he would talk. But there are other times with strangers. He seemed to lose the art of talking.
He obviously couldn't paint, and he couldn't see pictures or anything like that. So.
No. I think he was... that was the greatest strain on him of all. He could write. I mean, he used to do a rough thing. It was very... would take a piece of paper and write, and it would go this way and that. And he never overcame that. So after that, he used to dictate. And... that was easier.
Mm.
But even so, I was often overnight, or we'd stop, we'd go to bed and go to sleep and get up next morning. And during breakfast, he'd say, would you mind going back to so-and-so? I want to put a little thing in here. It was extraordinary that he remembered just where it was. I had to turn it back the page in with the paper and find it. Last I would find it.